This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. In the last couple of years, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut has gained attention for his forceful opposition to President Donald Trump and his warnings that the GOP president may be launching America into an authoritarian era. But the Democratic lawmaker is also an advocate for getting his party to understand why Trump gained so much popularity, especially among poor and working-class white voters. In his new book, Crisis of the Common Good, The Fight for Meaning and Connection in a Broken America, Murphy details how globalization and technological advances have eviscerated bonds that once made communities strong. To demonstrate this, Murphy points to Rich Men North of Richmond, a song by musician Oliver Anthony that rocketed up the Billboard charts a couple of years ago.
Rich men north of Richmond, Lord knows it all, just wanna have total control, wanna know what you think, wanna know what you do, and they don't think you know, but I know that you do, cause your dollar ain't shit, and it's taxed to no end, cause the rich.
Murphy notes that people's reactions to the song fell along partisan lines. Conservative pundits embraced Rich Men North of Richmond as a rally cry for the forgotten man. But many liberal listeners were put off by this part of the song.
Lord, we got folks in the street, ain't got nothing to heat, and the obese milk and welfare. God, if you're 5'3" and you're 300 pounds, taxes ought not to pay. Drowned. Young men are putting themselves 6 feet in the ground, cause all this damn country does is keep on kicking them down.
Murphy was in St. Louis last week to talk about his new book at St. Louis County Library, which is where St. Louis Public Radio politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum had a chance to talk with him.
After that song came out, I said, hey, I think we should be talking to all the people who find this song alluring. And I submit that many of them believe in these racist tropes, but they do seem like they are looking for a message that would unrig the economy. And hey, Democrats have the answers. And I got pilloried online for suggesting that, because people said he's a racist, his followers are racist, they're hopeless. We can't talk to them. I think that politics is not just talking to the people who agree with you. Politics is conversion. And if you just say that you agree with me on raising the minimum wage, but you don't agree with me on voting rights, I'm never talking to you, that's giving up on democracy.
Yeah.
So I argue that if you offer to bring some of those people into the tent, yeah, that might be a little awkward, but how am I ever going to have a chance to convert somebody and make them believe that welfare is not just for lazy people, or that drag shows are not the primary problem in your community, if I don't even get to talk to them?
Jason also asked Senator Murphy about whether there are limits to this approach, bringing up an example of how it may not be wise to bring someone like Nick Fuentes into the Democratic coalition. Fuentes is a far-right political commentator known for promoting white nationalist and anti-Semitic notions.
Yeah, I don't want Nick Fuentes or anybody who thinks like him anywhere near our tent, but that doesn't describe everybody who has voted for Donald Trump. And I think that we should be trying to win elections and trying to convince people who might not agree with us, might never agree with us on some of these very important issues, to vote for us. Because then when we have power, we can work on it all. And we just, I don't know, we've become kind of perfectionists in the Democratic Party. You got to agree with us on everything, or we don't want you anywhere near our coalition. I think that's a prescription to lose.
Senator Murphy's conversation with STLPR's Jason Rosenbaum was wide-ranging and explored many of the themes in Murphy's new book, Crisis of the Common Good. And for the rest of today's show, we'll listen to their conversation. Jason continued by asking the senator about one of his trademark political traditions, where he will, every year, walk across the entire state of Connecticut. For context, a north-south route across the state is about the distance between downtown St. Louis and Six Flags, round trip.
No, it certainly gets a lot of attention because I think I'm the only one to do it, although it's Connecticut, so it's easier to do here than in Missouri, for instance.
Okay, before you say anything,
yeah.
You served in the House when Kit Bond was a U.S. Senator. You probably don't remember him. He came before Roy Blunt and Eric Schmidt.
I know the name.
He lost to somebody who walked across Missouri, Joe Teasdale.
Walked the whole state?
Walking Joe Teasdale. He lost re-election as governor, but he ended up winning again. And he was a non-consecutive governor, and he eventually became a U.S. senator.
I know I did not, you know, invent this.
No.
There have been plenty of there's another big Democratic figure, Lawton Childs, right? Walkin' Lawton, who walked across Florida. No, certainly people know a lot about it, but I do it because about 10 years ago, I started to get worried that I was going to start believing that the things that were getting a lot of clicks online or the things being covered on cable news were the things that mattered to my constituents. And sometimes they are, but most of the time they aren't. And in fact, what that walk does, because I'm mainly talking to people who are not, you know, political, right? They don't watch the cable news shows. They barely pay attention to politics. What I realize over and over again every year is that they're just evergreen issues that matter to everybody that don't go away. It's education. It's the safety of your neighborhood. It's how much money are you making. And so the walk is, you know, just this grounding exercise for me. But I also, you know, meet a lot of interesting people. I think a few of them I talk about over the course of this book.
You spend a lot of time in your book comparing how things used to be before globalization and technology advances to where they are now. So I want to start this kind of line of questioning for you to describe Wethersfield, Connecticut. I hope I'm getting the name
you
correct.
You got it.
Good.
Nailed it.
What was it like as a kid and was it like now?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you're right that this book does do a lot of nostalgia. This book does, you know, a lot of talk that, you know, doesn't sound totally unfamiliar when you listen to the way that the right discusses a need to make America great again. And there's a lot of risk in that because nostalgia can be pretty gauzy and you can forget the really rough parts of the past. I try to be realistic about what we did right and what we did wrong generations ago, but we did a lot right. And one of the things that existed in my childhood that doesn't exist as much today is that we lived in unique, healthy, and connected local places. I grew up in this, you know, small suburb of Hartford that was unique. I talk about in this book, you know, the simple act of going every weekend to the grocery store with my grandmother. And, you know, the store was owned by our neighbors and the deli guy, you know, had worked there forever. He made a good salary so that he could stay working there. He would give me a free slice of American cheese every time that we walked up to the counter because my grandmother would chat with him for a little while. And while they chatted, I'd eat my cheese. And I thought I was the luckiest guy in the world, luckiest kid in the world getting this free cheese. But it bound me to my place because the people I interacted with every day, even at the stores, cared about me. And there were all sorts of other ways in which I felt like Wethersfield was unique. You know, I was grounded in my church. There were service clubs all over the place that sponsored our Little League. And I just think that existence is further away from people today. That supermarket is gone. In Wethersfield, you might shop at a corporate-owned grocery store, but you probably don't ever go into a store to buy your groceries. You do that alone. Less people belong to churches. The civic clubs in Wethersfield have kind of disappeared as people have disappeared into their phones and have to work 70 hours a week. Localness, feeling rooted in a place, belonging to a community, it's one of the essential elements of happiness. And we're less happy today. We just are. And I argue that part of that is because we've been told that you should just be happy being a global citizen and buying the same stuff that everybody else buys in the whole country from the same stores. That feels empty and incomplete to people. So the book talks about how you restore local identity in this country.
And you kind of alluded to this, but there's also a lot of tension when you bring up this nostalgia, because you mention in the book that multiple places and institutions that are highlighted, like auto unions in Detroit or Little League baseball that's sponsored by civic organizations, some of those institutions didn't let Black people or women in. Some of them were gated away from poor people, I would imagine. It also, to be fair, a lot of labor unions, especially in Detroit, made previously working class people, very middle class, and allowed them to live in the same street as some of the executives. But how do you like deal with that tension and the policies we're going to talk about? How do you like implement these policies without creating the same exclusionary things that made these nostalgic things not as rosy, basically?
Yeah, I think you just accept the tension, first of all. I mean, you don't have to erase nostalgia. You don't have to pretend as if there was nothing good going on in the 1960s and 70s just because there were some really not so good things going on. So yes, I admit that those service clubs, the Kiwanis, the Lions, the Rotary, the Civitan, that in the 1960s, one out of every three American males belonged to one of those clubs. That was a good thing, that people woke up every day and one of their primary tasks was belonging to a club that just did good things for their community. It was not a good thing that those clubs were almost exclusively male. But why couldn't you say, let's create a culture in which more people can belong to service clubs and just decide that this time it's going to be everybody, not just men? I think you can pick and choose what you want to bring forward while admitting that it was nowhere close to perfect.
I think beyond those aforementioned tensions, another really interesting one is how you kind of talk about Walmarts. And I think you use Walmart as this example of homogenization that is destroying these local businesses. But you also highlight somebody who worked at a Walmart for a long time, found value in that work, but at the same time was being grossly underpaid and wasn't able to have any money for retirement. And you also point out that Walmart is a place where poor people can buy stuff at a really cheap price. I feel like that is kind of one of, again, the inherent conflicts we have in America, that these large companies are ubiquitous and homogenous, but they're also useful to people. How do you square that circle?
Yeah, I just think it's correct to point out that people find value in the low prices at Walmart, but the reason why there is such a premium today on discount retail is because nobody's making any money. Well, it's true that Izzy, the guy that I met on my walk that I describe in this book, you know, took pride in working at Walmart. He also felt abandoned by them in the end because he had worked for 17 years full time and they paid him such terrible wages that he couldn't afford to retire. He's living a life that he describes as inhuman in his retirement. I think Walmart is a little clearer case in that I do think that the reason that we primarily prize Walmart is because of an underlying an underlying weakness, an underlying fatal flaw in our economy, that we just don't pay people money. And if we paid people what they deserve, then people would be less reliant on Walmart. And we could bring back, frankly, intentionally, places like Wethersfield Supermarket, where I got that free slice of cheese. And that would be good for people because they'd pay higher wages and people would feel more connected to their community because they're shopping locally.
That's U.S. Senator Chris Murphy talking with STLPR politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, was in St. Louis last week for an author event at St. Louis County Library. His new book is Crisis of the Common Good, The Fight for Meaning and Connection in a Broken America. We'll have more of their conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. Let's return to STLPR politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum's conversation with U.S. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. Murphy is the author of the new book, Crisis of the Common Good, The Fight for Meaning and Connection in a Broken America. He was in St. Louis last week for an author event at St. Louis County Library.
You split your book into multiple parts. We talked a lot about kind of the cult of everywhere and the lack of place. But you also talk about the cult of technology. And I want to actually talk about some of the specific ideas. You're a supporter of barring anybody who is 18 or under from getting a social media account. First of all, why and how would you actually enforce that?
So let me just back up for one second.
Sure.
So the book is divided into these six cults. And that's a strong word, right? It's meant to elicit a reaction.
Right. But I should have probably I probably should have mentioned that, but I feel like you're better at mentioning that than me, so continue.
Well, so what is a cult? A cult is a set of false beliefs that accrues to the benefit of one person or a handful of people. And that's what I argue has happened in this country, that we have, you know, come to have these false beliefs about how important profit is as a measure of success in our economy, the benefit that technology gives us versus the pitfalls, the amount of happiness you get from consumption as opposed to, say, citizenship. But on this cult of technology, there is this feeling that the market will just figure out how to protect us from the roughest edges of technology. And one of the roughest edges are these poisonous social media sites that are addicting our children to their phones and often feeding them super dangerous content. I actually don't believe that people under 18 shouldn't get a social media account. What I believe, it's just a slight difference.
Sure.
What I believe is that these self-perfecting algorithms, right, mm-hmm. that know you and feed you stuff to keep you addicted, those shouldn't turn on until you turn 18.
Got it. Thank you for correcting me on that. But continue.
So like when my kids first got on the internet, you know, we only allowed them to be on, you know, certain sites that had channels, right, that never changed, right? So if they wanted to be on the Minecraft channel, they could be on the Minecraft channel, but I could see what was on that channel. Yeah. I just think that that algorithm, which is addicting you, which is feeding your insecurities, which is often giving you content on, for example, self-harm, that just should be treated as a poison like a cigarette.
So I brought this idea up to Senator Josh Hawley, who I'm going to ask you about in a little bit. But one of the things that I thought of, because, you know, I like doing senators' jobs for them, is basically passing a law that says if you do not allow for people, especially children, to turn off the social media algorithm, you are not allowed to get U.S. federal government contracts. So that would affect Meta, Amazon, X, all of them. First of all, what do you think of that idea? And two, is there any possible way that could pass given how powerful these tech companies are for influencing your colleagues?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd have to get a little into the weeds on how that would work. I mean, technically—
It's admittedly just something that came into my head. So yeah. It may not have actually been practical, but
It's tough when you're talking about a truly biologically addictive product, right? Just giving the sort of option to turn off is not sufficient. We know that living in a world of addicts who are addicted to cigarettes and drugs and alcohol, they have the option at any time to turn off, but they don't because the product is literally biologically addicting them. That is what Meta and other companies are designing, biologically addictive products. So I think we've got to go further than just the optionality to turn it off, especially for developing minds, especially for 13-year-old kids.
So speaking of developing minds, I think that AI is different from social media.
Right.
I have an 8-year-old son, Declan Todd Rosenbaum, and he basically associates anything created with AI as schlock, substandard, fake, or worse than real, which I think is great because he's 8 years old. I feel like this is becoming more than just an 8-year-old's observation. I think that this is a widespread feeling that the things created by AI, writing, photos, videos, it's just schlock and bad quality. And you're kind of seeing this backlash to this idea that this sort of technology for those purposes is needed. You've probably seen that. Like, is that?
I don't know. Do you have teenagers?
I do not.
Right.
I have a 12-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 4-year-old.
Yeah, I don't know. The teenagers I hang around don't necessarily view AI in that way.
But I guess my question was, it's probably going to get better and better.
Correct.
So is that sustainable? That
yeah.
was my question.
I mean, I think, you know, what we know right now is that teenagers are using AI at scale to help them do their work. They are increasingly using these AI friendship bots, and those friendship bots are getting incredibly compelling as sources of advice and companionship, and there are signs that actually kids are flocking to them. So no, I don't think that we can rest believing, again, that the market, right, that a lack of sophistication of the technology is going to cause kids to voluntarily give it up. I think that we are going to actually have regulation to protect kids, as we frankly have had with every new breakthrough technology in the history of the country since the Industrial Revolution. When medicines came along, we regulated it. When nuclear technology came along, we regulated it. And we should do the same thing with AI. Not ban it, just make sure that kids and adults don't get the worst parts of it.
Okay, I've really been dying to ask you this question. And you kind of opened the door when you wrote in your book that we should really crack down on companies that claim their employees are independent contractors when they're not. And also to increase unionization. This is going to be a little on the nose, but I'm a huge professional wrestling fan. WWE is based in Connecticut. You ran against Linda McMahon.
I did.
Why in the world has Congress not done something to crack down on companies like WWE that say their wrestlers are independent contractors and not workers, but they're not allowed to work for other companies? Their likeness is like sold away to WWE for years. And this is not a podunk family company anymore. This is a multi-billion dollar corporation. Answer that question first, but then you can like broaden it to why like that point of about unionization is important.
Well, but I don't know that there's a specific question to why we're not doing it for that particular company, but the answer is pretty simple. Our politics are corrupt.
Yes.
They are corrupt, and there has been an intentional effort in this country to undermine organized labor for 40 years. Our politics has become bought by corporations and billionaires who love the fact that they get to treat, you know, employees not as employees but as independent contractors. And I argue too, because again, this book is really about the, you know, the emotional state of the country. How are you going to make people happier? And relevant to your question, two of the things that drive people the craziest is that they can't find community and shared purpose in their work, that their work seems soulless, all extractive for somebody else's profit. Unions are full of happier employees than in companies with without unions, because you have a sense of camaraderie, you have a sense of shared purpose. Normally, unions give you a stake in the company's decision making, but the politics being corrupt also has an emotional impact, because when you feel powerless at work, and you feel powerless in your politics because corporations have so much control, it leaves you wanting to blame somebody for the way in which you have been disempowered. And that's where these scapegoat artists like Donald Trump come along. So this question of how you protect workers is not just about, you know, the healthcare benefits they should be getting. It's also about a question of how you make people feel agency.
My terrible joke about why they haven't done that with WWE is that Stone Cold Steve Austin would give everybody a Stone Cold Stunner if they did that. Although I think it would benefit him if he was a full-time employee, but that's another question.
He may not see that.
Okay, you mentioned Josh Hawley a few times in your book as an example of a Republican who is willing to take on conventional wisdom about corporate power. Tell me why you mentioned him specifically.
Well, because he's unfortunately an outlier, right? And listen, I mean, I just want to be honest about Josh. He's somebody that I work with, but, you know, I mean, what he did on January 6th is just unforgivable, right? I mean, this is somebody who helped lead the effort to delegitimize the election, and none of us can forget that. But he is also somebody that I think understands the way in particular that these technologies and the companies that run these technologies are really destroying kids. And so he's been willing to, you know, work with me and others on legislation that preserves some of the spiritual health that's been lost as these kids have become addicted to technology and chatbots. So it's tough pickings these days, because there's nobody perfect to work with on the Republican side, but Josh certainly has shown a willingness to take on the pro-corporate conventional wisdom in the Republican Party.
So there is a common perception among Hawley's critics that he only focuses on things like criticizing big tech or criticizing corporations or being in favor of labor unions. For, as a sidebar, he was initially, when he ran for attorney general, for right to work. And then when I asked him about it in 2024, he's against it. And I guess he's abandoned that position. But I bring that up because there's a lot of questions about his sincerity on that. You've worked with him. Do you think he's sincere about a lot of the issues you just mentioned about corporations and labor.
I am 100% not in the business of psychoanalyzing my colleagues.
Oh man, like, I thought you were.
I have no idea. Obviously, he doesn't go far enough on any of this.
Okay, let me reorient the question. Does it matter if he's sincere, if he's doing good work? I think that often is like a big question about politics. If you're doing something good, does it matter if inside you are actually believing in it or whether you think it's just good for people, even if it's against your values?
Of course it matters. Yeah, of course it matters. Because, you know, when you're doing something that is countercultural in your party or more broadly, it takes real courage to continue to stand up to the forces of the status quo. And if you're not sincere, if you're doing it for, you know, temporary political gain, you're more likely to abandon the cause when things get hard. So, yes, of course it matters whether somebody is doing it for sincere reasons.
So the last time I saw you was last year when you appeared at a rally in St. Louis County in Ann Wagner's 2nd Congressional District. But you mentioned in the book that you feel that just defeating Republicans and ushering out the Trump era is not enough. Like, you can't just win an election if you're not going to change the culture and this and the character of this country. I'd like you to delve into that if you could.
The first time I mentioned Trump in this book, it's in a way that will, I don't know, feel a little cold to MSNBC viewers. I say Trump is not the central problem. He is a symptom of the central problem. Yes, I want to beat him. I was obviously here in Missouri last year because I want to elect more Democrats and I want to purge him from the body politic. But I also think that he's a symptom of something that's more fundamentally broken. People are less connected. They're less happy. The economy has abandoned people. And when people wake up every day and they don't feel purpose and meaning in their life, they are prone to be attracted to scapegoating politicians. He says, you're miserable, and let me tell you who's making you miserable: immigrants and Muslims and gay kids. Now, that's totally wrong, but if you don't solve that underlying spiritual rot that's happening in the country, even if Trump gets defeated electorally, somebody else who's kind of like him will come along, and people will just continue to be unhappy. So yet my charge here is big, which is, you know, I'm basically saying, yeah, you got to do all the work to beat him, but you also have to build a culture of the common good, an economy of the common good. And that takes a lot of work and a lot of changes, both in the public and the private sector. But I guess I have high expectations of people.
My last question, it kind of goes into this. Is it going to require people actually talking about this face to face, not online, not on their phones, not through text? Because I feel like if I talked about everything that I feel about neurodivergence and developmental disabilities to somebody who is polar opposite of me, I don't know if we'd come out agreeing with each other. But if we were talking face to face and we saw each other as people and we did a lot of the social things you were talking about in this book, at least we would understand people's perspectives better and not see them as these faceless avatars. So I'm interested to hear about, do we need to be having these discussions face to face instead of online?
I mean, the answer is yes. And in the end, this book says we have to build a community of the common good. And that definitely means we have to be in more in-person connection with each other and sometimes with people that we don't agree with politically. And then it's not just up to government to do that. Yes, I believe that government has made it a lot harder for people to spend time in person with members of their community. And I lay out a whole bunch of changes that will allow us to have more meaning and purpose and connection in our lives. But it is up to us as well. I mean, I give this, you know, give me 2 minutes and I'll tell this quick story. But I end with this kind of simple story about my life. When I was, you know, home on Thanksgiving morning, a really tough morning for me, the first Thanksgiving after my wife and I had separated and my kids were with her, I was alone and I was doing what you'd expect. I was scrolling through my phone. I was not feeling great about myself. But I knew that there was this family on the little city green that I live next to that on Thanksgiving morning normally put out a coffee table and handed out free donuts to and breakfast to the homeless. And I decided to put down the phone and go to the green and just spend some time with people and people who were giving back and with, you know, people that disagreed with me on certain things. And I spent probably an hour. And I just, like, I felt my spirits lift because, A, I was doing the thing that drives endorphin release, which is in-person connection, and I was exercising this selflessness muscle that we all have kind of lost. And so everybody can do little things like that, something bold, like throw a block party for your neighborhood this summer, something small, like just show up and help a nonprofit that's doing something like that family was doing. And it's up to the public sector, but also just all of us individually to invest in that common good.
Or delete your Twitter account, which I did. And I feel a lot better after doing that. Oh. I'm not saying you have to. I know you have a popular
one. I'm envious.
I have not quit all my social media, but I felt a lot better not doing that. Senator, thank you so much
for
your time.
Thank you.
Chris Murphy is a U.S. Senator from Connecticut. He spoke with STLPR politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Murphy was in St. Louis last week for an author event at St. Louis County Library. His new book is Crisis of the Common Good, The Fight for Meaning and Connection in a Broken America.
This episode was produced and recorded by Jason Rosenbaum. Audio editing by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.